Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we're going to be touching on a little bit of history. But if any of you have a bit of the Irish in your family history, I think you're going to find my guest, John Wesley Thomas, a very interesting man. He and his wife, Sandra Lynn, have come out with a book that is spectacularly gorgeous. If you have any Irish friends and they want to know what to get them, they have got everything in God's world that they could possibly want. You say, what could I get them that they would never expect? This is a book that you'll want to know about. It's called St. Patrick's Day and the Irish Collectibles. It is a phenomenal book regarding the history of this absolutely amazing country, people, and its history is something that is bigger than the land itself. I want to welcome John Wesley Thomas to the airwaves with me this morning. Hi.
Hi. How you doing again, Donna?
Well, I'm doing wonderfully. When I saw you, earlier in the year, in February, you and your lovely wife came up to my booth, which I had at a particular expo I was participating in, and we had a little bit of a conversation, and you were telling me about this book, The St. Patrick's Day and Irish Collectibles. And I said, oh, my goodness, you got to get it to me by St. Patrick's Day. Well, that didn't happen. So I'm chatting with you today, but I absolutely have nothing but the deepest appreciation for all of the work that you and your wife do to bring forth facts and history that when it comes to collectibles, who had a clue? I didn't. That St. Patrick's Day had all of these various items, and we'll be talking about them later, but I want to go into the history of Ireland. What prompted this? From what I read, you have two Irish grandmothers, is that true?
Yes, I do. The one Irish grandmother that I had, I was able to trace through genealogical records back to County Tipperary. And that led me to go to Ireland. We went to Ireland about 6 or 7 years ago. And with the help of some local Irish genealogist, I was able to trace and found a second cousin of the Tuohy clan living in County Tipperary. And we went to their farmhouse and knocked on the door. And that's how this all came about. Tommy Tuohy was in his late 80s at the time. He's regrettably has passed on, but we still keep in contact with his wife. So we were collecting St. Patrick's Day memorabilia at the time. In fact, my wife and I, as you know, we have had two books out on Thanksgiving. Both were based on our collections, which was the largest probably in the world. And we feel this St. Patrick's Day collectibles is also probably the largest in private hands. Most Irish collectibles have come about due to the parades that the Irish seem to embark upon on March 17th of any year. And when the Irish immigration came into the United States as a result of the Great Potato Famine in the mid-1800s, 1840s to 1850s, the Irish felt themselves put down by the already people that were living in the United States, and they had to somehow or another show their Irish ways. So the way they went about it was to have a parade. And out of these parades came a whole host of collectibles, all generally in the color of green. So that's why today it's always wearing the green, which came about actually as the color of the green shamrock, which way back in the legendary times of St. Patrick used the shamrock to impart Christianity to the local inhabitants, who at the time were using a form of Druidism a Celtic religion of the time, and he used the three leaf, the shamrock, is explaining the Holy Trinity, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. So that's how it came about.
It fascinates me how every grouping of people have particular patterns with colors. I was just reviewing material on Scotland yesterday, and green is considered a negative in their environment. And I just thought, isn't this interesting? You're all relatives, you know. You're all located in the same area, and one says one color is not so hot, the other one says, "Whoopee, this is great," which is exactly with St. Patty's and in our culture here in the United States, especially anybody that gets into the study of colors, green has always been a very healthy color. So it's fascinating to see how peoples will delegate or designate things as being good, bad, or indifferent.
Well, now, Halloween is a good example, black and orange, right?
Right, absolutely. So we have these particulars, and I think that's one of the gifts that history can bring to us, an understanding sometimes of why we have evolved in certain systems. But I want to talk about the land of Ireland itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because you make a comment in your book, you talk about the Paleolithic era, which was 18,000 to 9,000 BC. Now, what's intriguing to me is you go into quite a bit of interesting detail, but you say nothing is known about proto-human settlements in Ireland prior to the start of the most recent glaciation, which started 70,000 years ago, and is referred to as the Midlandian Glaciation by Irish geologists. Now, we're talking about massive ice sheets.
Right.
And it shifted, and then you get ended up with the permafrost, like we've got up in Alaska.
True.
And the ice age ended in Ireland and the globe. Every time there's a tilt in the axis, weather is affected dramatically. This has been proven by science over and over again. Ireland, in and of itself, is not a very big place.
No, it's it's actually a very small island. During that last ice age, the whole of Ireland was covered with a massive sheet of ice. It was nearly 2 miles in thickness, which kind of led to the reason why getting back to the legend of St. Patrick is why he banned all snakes from Ireland. Actually, when you had an ice sheet going over the whole country, everything was lost. And there was no snakes and no human beings or anything. And it took the warming of the globe, as you said, with the axis changing a little bit, the warming of the globe brought back a certain amount of tillable or arable earth to the area of Ireland, at that time called Hibernia by the Romans. And eventually Celtic tribes coming from mid-Europe spread all over the known world at that time, and they used a certain amount of boats to get to England. And at that time, there was thought to be a land bridge between England, which was called Britannia, and Hibernia, which is now known as Ireland. There was a land bridge. So there were Celtic tribes going in that area. And as you mentioned about permafrost, when the Stone Age evolved into the Iron Age, it made it easier for those inhabitants to cut down trees, much easier with an iron axe rather than a stone axe. And they rapidly depleted the forest there. And, of course, Ireland being a very cold and wet country as it is, this is how the bog started up and the peat. It took over 2,000 years for an area of arable land to turn into basically an acidic bog, which there was no use at all to the local people. So it's a very intriguing history. And I went into the Ice Age, going into the Stone Age, the Iron Age, the Copper Age, to show exactly how the Celtic tribes existed at that time, and they therefore the coming of Christianity through the efforts of St. Patrick, which was in about 432 A.D.
I find that your photography in this book is, as always, with anything that you put out, utterly spectacular. One of the things that I find intriguing is that they have done archaeological digs in many parts of Europe, and they are discovering that these people were not a bunch of ding-dongs wandering around. They were very skilled artisans. You know, so often it's like me, Tarzan, you, Jane kind of mentality. And you have the most spectacular photographs in this book. One is an Irish gold gorget neck collar. Now, that took tremendous sophistication. We would have a difficult time even today for a jeweler to produce that kind of fine detail work. It takes a real craftsman to do it. You also have an Irish gold torque bracelet that's small, that's twisted gold to resemble a cord tassel that was used on dresses. I mean, these were people. These were very, very skilled people. They knew their metal craft. They understood these things. And then what I found, what was really amazing, I was not aware of this. It's called a passage tomb. And this is in County Meath, Ireland. They are huge, and they were astronomically situated to receive light into the burial chamber. Now, this means these people knew a heck of a lot more than what we give them credit for.
Right. It was sort of based on, well, like Stonehenge in England. It was the same pattern. And, or you can find that in Middle America, the through the Aztecs or the Incas. They also, you know, had their tombs or to receive a certain amount of light and everything. This gold jewelry that you spoke of was came about during the late Bronze Age, and gold necessarily wasn't found in Ireland at that time. They had a lot of copper. So trade links were established between various seafaring groups, and copper was a an export, you might say, from Hibernia, and gold and silver were brought in, and this allowed these people to form these very, very delicately made and beautifully almost pure gold amulets, collars, and necklaces. And, of course, the landed gentry, the Sheftons, and these are the people that had these made. And, you know, Ireland was a very, very small, had a very small population base of only 150,000 people, and this lasted about 2,000 years. So it was very little, there was a certain amount of trade, but very little amount of people coming into Ireland from other areas because it was a small, cold Ireland, and agricultural, as we know it, wasn't a very, very big thing at that time. So it's, but trade links throughout the world, throughout the known, basically, Roman Empire, which was established at the time, that's how all these things occurred and everything.
When you, when I was reviewing the history, I thought, my goodness, and I say Celtic, and I know it's it can be pronounced either way, Celtic or Celtic.
Right, right.
which is always fun to me, because whenever I participate in a Renaissance fair, this comes up invariably as a discussion one way or the other, and it's just fun. But there was a war aristocracy in Celtic Ireland, and it was called Hibernia at the time. I was intrigued with the fact that they had cattle, and I thought, I wonder where that cattle came from, because the Maasai in Africa have had cattle. The Scots have their cattle. In fact, they're known for their particular breed of cattle. Now, the cattle in Ireland, were they like the Scottish cattle, which was a breed specifically to survive the very difficult environment that they had to live in?
Right. Well, that is probable. There was this land bridge that most people assume came from Scotland, which at that time was called Caledonia. And that land bridge at the southern part of Scotland came into the northern part of Ireland. And At the time, Ireland did not have many indigenous animals because of this ice age. They had some very large, what we call elk, and some other mammals, but cattle was brought in, and unfortunately, this cattle contributed to the lack of arable ground because of the bogs were, you know, being affected at that time. The one interesting thing about Irish and the people who ruled the Ireland, there were just many, many settlements of a very small, what we call kingdoms or chiefdoms, all surrounded by ring forts, and these ring forts were allowed these people to defend themselves. And one of the coming of ages for Irish noblemen, as we can call noblemen at that time, was cattle rustling. It was a coming of age, and so people that lived in one ring fort and had a certain amount of cattle were preyed upon by others, stronger groups, and cattle rustling was a big thing, much like in our Western America of, you know, 100 years ago. So it was a big thing to embark upon massive cattle raids. And a lot of the old Irish music came out of this type of tradition.
You talk about the monastery that
kept,
of course, the people in the monasteries were some of the few that were educated at that time.
In Latin, typically.
Yes, and they were educated in Latin, and you had sometimes hundreds of monks that were copying books because the printing press wasn't available. They were in isolation. A lot of these monasteries held very, very special written materials, and the average person in the population couldn't read, couldn't write, and the Catholic Church at that time really didn't want them to.
Right.
So they kept records, though, and a lot of information was handed down by word of mouth because that was the oral tradition. That's how you passed on your history. But you used a word that I'm not familiar with, hagiography, and I may be mispronouncing it. She said
That's right.
Hagiography. Tell us what that is and what you discovered about them.
Right. Well, that's hagiography or hagiography was basically a study of saints or very, very important people. So there was a big written or spoken tradition, in some written, about the lives of saints at that time. And there were three saints that came about during the Patrick era. One was St. Patrick, one was St. Bridget's. And they all had a certain amount of local myths around them. And that was the study of these folks. As you mentioned, there was no really localized churches in Ireland at the time, again, because of the lack of population. So most of the Christianity that came out or through the surrounding areas were from monasteries. And this lasted about 300 years until what came through the local waters, the Vikings. So the Viking raids started around 795 A.D., and the Vikings knew a good thing when they saw it. They knew that the local inhabitants had very little except maybe some sheep or cattle, but it was the monasteries that were the holders of most of the value, whether it was illustrated books, as you mentioned, Book of Kells being a good example, by the way, or other valuables. And so the monasteries were subject to repeated raids by the Vikings. And many of the names in Ireland today, Dublin being one, was the result of the use of the Viking or the Nordic languages, you know, merging with the known Celtic languages at the time. So we can thank our friends from Scandinavia that they imparted some of their values, you might say, into Ireland today, and probably made them a more, a more potent group of people.
There's a part of Irish history that I can say is absolutely tragic, and I did not become aware of the history. I had heard of the potato blight when I was a kid in school. But there was not the information about how the British were responsible for hundreds of thousands of people dying from starvation. Now, this was interesting, the history that you presented, because in 1844, there was a shipment of seed potatoes sent from Peru to Belgium farmers, and then it went from there to Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
There was a fungus on this, and it was carried by the winds, and Ireland is damp, wet. It's not unlike the Pacific Northwest. And this blight spread. And for many of the people, this was their primary food. You know, we talk about how healthy the potato is, and you think of the Andes, the people in the Andes. They had, I don't know how many species of potatoes. That's where we got potatoes. Were from
exactly.
South America.
Mm-hmm.
And they would preserve it, and they had a number of different species. Well, in Ireland, their temperatures were wet and moist, and fungus will just grow like crazy if it gets cool and there's moisture in the air. Believe me, I've seen this happen to food, root vegetables, and potatoes are root vegetables. And the entire population, almost, except for the very wealthy, depended on this. And in 6 years, you go from 1844 to 1851, this just blew me away. Ireland's population declined by 23% to 6.55 million, of which 1.17 million died.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it took over 100 years for this little country to recover. And the history about the farmer, and there was no protein from cattle, sheep, or any other grain for the small farmer. And the English were taking potatoes out of this country like crazy. They were taking it, shipping it to Britain, and these people were starving to death. Yet the Society of Friends of Quakers, what is it that they did? I mean, they broke the whole tradition. What did they do?
Well, this was going back a little bit. In 1607, the Irish, under the leadership of King James, was defeated by William of Orange at the Battle of Boyne, and the whole country was subjugated, and the Irish Catholic Church was obviously put down, and the form of Protestantism, a Calvinistic form under Cromwell, was impeded. So the Irish farmers were under the heel of the English landowners, okay? And as you said, in the pretty much the western part of the country, potatoes were the crop. And for 50% of the Irish, it was the only food they had, potato. That was it. And when the potato famine came about, the Irish had no way of giving anything back to their English landowners, so they were forced off the land. They were just kicked out because they could pay no rents. So the Society of Quakers, they came in they volunteered. This was really around the 1600, 1650, and they came in and actually started up soup kitchens, you might call soup kitchens what we would call today, to help these Irish out. So this promoted the Irish diaspora, which was the first wave of immigration from Ireland into the United States. At the time, before the, as you mentioned, the Great Potato Famine, Ireland had a population of over 8.5 million people, and it went all the way down by 50%. And as you said, it's just slowly coming back to about 6 million today. But it was a horrible time. There are reports of people dying with a green foam at their mouth. This is because they were trying to eat grass. This is the only thing they had. Everything else was given to the British. So cattle, sheep, and milk, butter, all that was imported or exported from Ireland into England. And even the fisheries, you'd be, why couldn't they catch fish? The streams and lakes were controlled by the British. So the Irish had really nowhere to go except leave the country. And that's how most of the Irish came about to the United States today. And that's how they always got together as a clan. And the only way they could participate in showing their Irishness, as I said before, was the parading. And that came about on March 17th. And it was that time in the 1600s that March 17th was selected as the birth the day that St. Patrick died, on March 17th. So, a lot of history behind that.
Oh, it is. And I think it's so important to know these little aspects of history, because we have to realize that things went on that we were not taught in history class. We're not aware of what caused this phenomenal migration. And when the Irish came into the United States, it's often been said that the Irish women are some of the most independent women on this planet. And they were that way because in their culture, many times it was the women that held the family together.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
They were out there, they were the ones that were working, and I think the belief system is pretty strong today that the Irish women are not something you fool around with. They were the first, they were female feminists long before the term ever became in style here in the United States.
And the bad aspect of that, by the way, is because the Irish men could no longer work or you know, provide for their families, they succumbed to drink. And unfortunately, many families were torn asunder due to that. And an interesting part, a lot of the Irish collectibles have to do with drinking, naturally. Either whiskey or beer. They're some of the biggest collectibles that you would have if you wanted to collect St. Patrick's and Irish collectibles. So there was a large temperance union set up by local priests in Ireland to offset this scourge of drinking. It was just a horrible fact of nature that that's how this bad aspects of life came about. But you're very right. It was the Irish woman, the matriarchs, that held together the family as best they could. And a lot of them went to, you know, you heard about the Irish lace. Irish lace was a tradition brought down by the Irish woman to make a little money, and evolved into a wonderful lace-making society. And a lot of this Irish lace, of course, was also exported not only to England but other parts of the world. So so good came out of that as well.
Yes, and when the women came here to the United States, the Irish women, they typically, the only jobs that were available to them when they started immigrating over was often cleaning jobs or, you know, being a nanny. And
right.
You think of those times and that era, women were not encouraged to get an education, so they had to do that kind of work, but there was that character within the Irish women that they said, I am going to become educated, and if I don't, my kids are. And they were really very, very strong in that level, and they ended up going sometimes into businesses of their own, which I
absolutely
found very interesting.
Yep.
Now, John, we're going to be going on break pretty soon. Would you stay with me? Because I want to talk about some of the collectibles that you...
Oh, sure. I'll be standing tall.
All right, sir. Well, this is Donna Sebo. My guest today is John Wesley Thomas. This fabulously beautiful book, it's called St. Patrick's Day and Irish Collectibles. It's an illustrated history, and the illustrations are just breathtakingly beautiful. And the history, my goodness. If you've got any Irish in you at all, you'd definitely want to know about this book, because it's going to give you information that perhaps you had no knowledge about whatsoever. This small island country that had produced and still produces this independent spirit that is absolutely vitally necessary, as far as I'm concerned, in this life of ours, because it promotes independence and self-sufficiency, especially among the women. So we're going to take a break here for just a moment. When we come back, we're going to be talking to you about some of the collectibles, and who knows, maybe in your grandma's pantry or someplace else in your family, if you've got any Irish history, you might have something that is of value. Don't go away. We're going to be right back.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. We're talking with John Wesley Thomas. He and his wife, Sandra Lynn, have a little bit of Irish history in their own family, and they put together this book, St. Patrick's Day and Irish Collectibles. Well, we've been talking about history, and John, I wanted to go into some of the collectible items that you have illustrated in your book, and I had no idea that there were so many collectibles. Now, let's pick up on what you mentioned. You were talking about how alcoholism was a real problem among the Irish men because basically they weren't working. They didn't have a chance to do jobs, and it was that way for many generations. I was fascinated with how the Anheuser-Busch Company had produced these phenomenal mugs. They are absolutely beautiful.
Yes, they came out with a series of them. Of course, Anheuser-Busch is probably the largest producer of beers in the United States. They at least have a 51% share of the market. So they decided to issue collectible beer steins in the 1980s. And in about 1991, they issued their first in a long series of St. Patrick's Day themed steins. And they're very collectible today. We have about the first 10 years or so, and we decided that, you know, we could stop it there. But Hamm's Brewery also came out with beer steins, and of course all the Irish brewing firms in the United States, besides Anheuser-Busch, all had their local beer cans produced to, you know, during a parade or some other Irish event. So they're all very, very collectible. And also, you know, there's a lot of other, like Hard Rock Cafe came out with a series of pins. Each year at most of the Hard Rock Cafe restaurants, they would issue a special pin in honor of St. Patrick's Day. So there's a lot of collectibles associated with drinking and food as well. You know, if you're going to have a good beer or a good shot of whiskey, well, with it goes some very good Irish food. And we go into that chapter as well about Irish foods. And, of course, after dinner, what are you going to have? Probably an Irish coffee. So mm-hmm. We went into that as well.
Right. Now, this is the recipe for Irish coffee that you've got a copy of here in your book. You say, into a large warm whiskey glass, pour one standard glass, one gill of Irish whiskey, add strong mm-hmm. black coffee up to 3/4 full, add plenty of sugar, average 2 teaspoonfuls, top by adding pure or whipped cream, pour gently over a teaspoon, do not stir, the result, delicious Irish coffee. And I know that there are many people that enjoy that. But I got a kick out of this rhyme that you have in the book that you say it's boxty. Boxty on the griddle, boxty in the pan. If you don't eat your boxty, you'll never get a man. What is boxty?
Well, boxi is a form of food based, of course, on potato.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, almost everything was based on a root vegetable, potatoes, and parsnips and turnips. So that was a form of food, much like a Col Canan, which is another traditional Irish dish, which was based on, potato and some sort of a green vegetable like kale, for instance, in this case.
Now, the leprechauns, those of us that love the stories about the Irish, you think of Darby O'Gill and the Little People that was put out by Disney. Those sweet little characters, the wee little fairies, all of those wonderful, wonderful personalities. There is a plethora of these beautiful ceramic pieces that were made. And, you know, you've got one leprechaun leaning on the wall. You have so many of these in here. And this is such a significant part of the Irish folklore.
Right. There are many symbols of what we would call, having to do with Ireland and St. Patrick's Day symbols. And we discussed wearing the green, which had to do with shamrocks. But then there was the music, the harp, a shillelagh, clay pipes, top hats, pigs, potatoes, and you mentioned Irish fairies and leprechauns. They all were important symbols of Irish fair, and of course we covered each one of them by illustrating the history, how each one of these symbols came about.
You talk about, in the collectible items that you have illustrated here, you talk about celluloid and plastic figures. Now, these started coming out from Japan in the 1950s. Now, people that are interested in collectibles, whether it's Irish or otherwise, how in the world do you keep the celluloid from deteriorating? Because that is one of the biggest challenges with anything that came out in the 1950s. And, of course, that
right.
was the beginning of the development of various plastics, which in today's world, it takes 50,000 years before they'll dissolve. So what is this with
celluloid?
Well,
you know, the problem with celluloid, it is a flammable substance, and it will decompose over time. The Japanese basically use this material to produce many of their toy figures from not just iron, but any toy figure that the Japanese did from the mid-1920s to the mid-1930s. But then with the war years coming on, celluloid kind of after World War II segued into the use of plastic. And they supplemented celluloid due to the low cost of manufacture of plastic. And plastic had a much more flexible and durable, and it was a chemically resilient piece of nature. So that was okay.
You go into the plush animals. Now, most of us know about the teddy bear that came out around Roosevelt's time. But and that was Teddy Roosevelt, not Franklin.
Right.
But
right.
Here you've got a whole array of Beanie Babies. Do they still manufacture Beanie Babies? I know they were the hot thing for a few years there. But are they still manufacturing them?
Yeah, they're still manufacturing them. Obviously, as you said, like plates in the 1970s were a hot item, plush animals like Beanie Babies, the Cabbage Pack dolls. Every one of these had a tremendous amount of fads, but they still do them today. And we showed an array of them because they're really cute, and they're all bears for the most part. And then also the other collectible was Snoopy. You know, Snoopy during St. Patrick's Day, he and his little buddy Woodstock were also, we also prominently showed those. But an important part of our section on dolls is that we have many dolls that are one of a kind, made by local artists, typically in Middle America. And we show a whole array of one of a kind dolls that were made to look like leprechauns, or Raggedy Ann and Andy type dolls, druid priest, anything that would look primitive or raggedy in a sense. So we have a whole collection of those. purchased from these people, and they're, again, one of a kind, which I think is important.
You have also a collector's section on music, and there's just this amazing group of Irish songs, and I have a picture of Bing Crosby in front of me. That's an Irish lullaby, and that's Tu-ra-lu-ra-lu-ral. That's an Irish
right.
lullaby. And Bing Crosby, that just became so very, very popular, and that came out in 1944. So you've got
right.
all
he
of this Irish
music.
He was
tremendous, as we know. He was an Irish crooner. He and another one, Dennis Day, which was also a very important singer at that time with his high tenor voice, they popularized Irish music. But there are probably over 1,200 individual sheets of Irish music available that one could collect if one wanted to. There's a tremendous depository of Irish music at New York University donated by a famed Irish musician, and he donated his whole collection there, and that was an interesting thing. But not only is there Irish sheet music, but there's also music boxes, and of course these music boxes, if you wound them up, would typically play, Irish lullabies or anything of that Irish music nature. So it was, they were also very collectible as well.
Well, the collection you have is just amazing. I was flabbergasted at the amount of postcards, other printed material that date way back. You have the Kewpie dolls. You even have the Kewpie dolls with an Irish, a four-leaf clover. And it's an amazing collection. It's really a feast for the eyes. You just have so much beautiful, beautiful art in here. The Blarney Stone is featured, and I'm just amazed at the amount of cultural history you have been able to put together in this beautiful, beautiful book. With this, satisfying?
Kudos to my wife. She is the premier postcard collector and paper ephemera, so a part of that book is devoted to beautiful postcards, either Irish signed or through some form of symbolism. So she put together this part of the book, as she did for our Thanksgiving books, as well as our Irish collectibles, for our America's Patriotic Collectibles book. As I say, all of our books are illustrated histories. You know, you can read about history, and it's dry and boring, but unless you have illustrations to go with history, that is much punchier and brings out a whole a measure of consideration for the history of virtually anything, of any holiday. And we specialize in illustrated histories of holidays, by the way. So.
Well, I just think this is absolutely gorgeous, and it would make a fabulous gift for someone. As I said earlier, if you have any Irish history and you know of someone that's passionately Irish, they would love this. This is just absolutely gorgeous. But to share it with your kids so that
right.
they understand about a culture of a people, what their history has been going way, way back, tens of thousands of years, and what we've got going on today. St. Patrick's Day and Irish Collectible. John, I know we're just about out of time. What is the website people can go to find out more about your wonderful materials?
Well, that's a good point. We do not have a website. We are probably going to develop one because of our next two books that are coming out. And then
mm-hmm.
we'll have five books out on illustrated histories of holidays. And we're taking a little change from holidays. Our fifth book will be on Death Valley National Park.
Well, I think what people can do is go to shipperbooks.com.
So we don't have a website, but so we can be reached through our publisher, Schiffer Publishing, that publishes
mm-hmm.
all our books, and they're out of Pennsylvania. Or the books can be purchased on Amazon.com as well.
Right. St. Patrick's Day, we're out of time, John. St. Patrick's Day and Irish collectibles are absolutely awesome. I'm telling you, it's just fabulous. So if you want to check it out, go to shifferbooks.com. That's shifferbooks.com. Also, you can check it out on Amazon.com. John Thomas, I look forward to your next publication, and have a magnificent, magnificent summer. This is Donna Sebo.
We'll look forward to seeing you in the fall.
Yes, sir. We'll
Thank
be
you,
taking
Donna,
a break
very much.
For just a moment, and we'll be right back.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are now open. Give me a buzz if you'd like to have me give you a little bit of intuitive insight. 888-627-6008 is the toll-free number to call in to, 888-627-6008. I want to quickly let you know that tomorrow we're going to be talking about pharmaceuticals. And if you know of anyone that's been going through extreme pain or is addicted to pharmaceuticals, this, I think, is a show you're going to want to listen to. Lou Paradise is going to be my guest, and we are going to be talking about what people can do to help deal with this addictive situation, which is really affecting so many people, and it's a real challenge. So we're going to be talking about that tomorrow, and then on Thursday, Healing from Heaven with Daniel Ryan, and on Friday, we're going to be honoring a woman who is very special. She served in a number of military campaigns. We're going to be speaking with the woman who has written the story of her life, Beverly Thompson. The title is The Colonel is a Lady. So we've got some dynamic conversations that are going to be going on this week. I invite you to join us here every morning, 9 to 10 Pacific time on the Donna Sebo Show. I wanted to share a little bit of information with you about Ernest Hemingway. Now, he was absolutely a brilliant writer. To this day, he is recognized for his tremendous power with words. Now, there's a story about Ernest Hemingway that I was not aware of. He apparently created the shortest short story ever told. Now, again, this is a legend. He was having lunch at New York City's famous Algonquin Round Table, and Hemingway was bragging that he could write a captivating tale complete with a beginning, middle, and end using only 6 words. That's a challenge, don't you think? Well, the writers that were around him, his peers, refused to believe it. Every one of them bet $10 that he couldn't do it. So after all the bets were made and there was all this excited energy, Hemingway scribbled very quickly 6 words down on a napkin and passed it around. As each of the writers at that table read the napkin, they agreed. He did what he said he could do. What were those words? For sale, period. Baby shoes, period. Never worn, period. Well, whoever did write the baby shoes has forced writers forever, apparently, to consider the economy of words. And that simple story inspired countless six-word memoirs and story competitions proving that a story's brevity is no limit to its power. I would say advertisers have known that for a long, long time. Wouldn't you say that? This is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. 888-627-6008. I wanted to share a story with you about a woman who cares so much about people, about life. Her name is Viola, or maybe it would be pronounced by some Viola. And she, like all of us many times, we get up in the morning, we turn on the radio, or we turn on the television, or maybe you have your smartphone and you use that, putting that up against the bathroom mirror. But she really would not be inclined to go right for the news like so many people do. She decided she wanted the habit of meditation. However, this particular morning, the television was on, and she couldn't do what she wanted to do normally. She just was absolutely, totally engrossed in what was going on the television. There was a particular station that was talking about problems, about an elderly woman. And what Viola noticed, she said, here's this little, tiny, gray-haired woman telling this reporter, I just don't know what to do. Now, the woman's name was Maribel that was being interviewed. She was 87 years old. She had no family. She had outlived them all. Her friends, she had outlived them. Every neighbor that she had known had either died or moved away. And this lady lived in Detroit. She was all alone. She had nobody to turn to, and she didn't know what else to do but to contact this station that was having the show solving people's problems. She said, I'm all alone here, and I'm scared. If I call for help, who is going to hear me? Well, Viola, when she was listening to this, she couldn't take her eyes off the screen. She said, that would be terrible, feeling so alone, not having anybody that you could call upon. Viola's own mother had turned 100 years of age. Now, Viola's family was a good-sized one. She had four other siblings, and she said, there were a lot of neighbors to take care of my mom or to keep an eye on her, because being 100 years of age is quite a special thing. However, Viola thought about this woman. It just could not leave her mind. She said, what can we do? We need to let these seniors know that they count. And every time she thought of this 87-year-old woman that had been on television saying, what do I do? I'm scared. I don't know what to do. She got the idea that she should put together an organization that provides companionship to seniors. Now, she knew it was going to be a big job. She had a friend who was a caregiver. She had a sister-in-law who was a nurse. She contacted the Red Cross. And what she was doing was finding out, what do we need to be aware of in taking care of the elderly? She ran an ad on her cable television station, put up flyers. Do you know? Her phone started ringing like crazy. She couldn't believe how many people wanted to help. So she then developed a process where she would match companions to seniors where they had similar interests and their personalities were compatible. And she said it was important for the seniors to feel like they had a friend. Well, she was getting responses from volunteers telling her how much it meant to them that they were able to help a senior citizen. And many of the seniors were talking about how much it meant to them where someone would go with them for a walk and to talk to them, explain things to them, just share some time. Well, she knew she had something very special. Now, she's been doing this for over 3 years. She has an in-home companion service, and she said, my mother lived to be almost 102. And she said, this is my way of giving back to my community. She said, I want others to know that they aren't alone that someone cares, because that's what everyone needs in their lives, and they deserve to have that. So there's all kinds of things that can be done. Check out different organizations if you'd like to volunteer this. But, you know, one person makes such a difference. You need to realize that. You, just like Viola, can make a difference in life by just committing yourself to something that touches your heart. You don't need to have banners waving. Just go out and do what really means the most to you. This is Donna Siebel. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Thank you for sharing this hour with me. I look forward to sharing another one with you right here on BBS Radio, station number one, tomorrow, same time, same place, here on BBS. Donna Siebel, bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.